Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage. I'm Tor Norby from the Android Tools team.
I'm Chet Haas from the UI Toolkit team. And today we have two people from which team? Tor's team. Again.
Yeah. Tools rule. All right. So let's start with you.
Hey, I'm Jamal Eason. I'm a product manager on the Android Studio team. And I work specifically on the Android emulator.
Hey, I'm Juan Ren. I'm a TLM from Android emulator.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about the emulator.
Nobody cares about emulators, do they? Like, we never hear from developers, hey, work on the emulator. We'd like it to be faster and better. That's not really a thing, is it? So it's kind of a niche topic today, but we're only talking about it because we're interested in it.
Yeah. No, that was one of those constant feedbacks after talks in public. Hey, emulator, when is it going to be faster? And we kept saying, yeah, you know, soon. We're working on something. And we eventually did. I think, when did we release emulator 2.0?
You know, we did Emulator 2.0 about a year and a half ago. I think at Android Developer Conference we did, we launched it. And since then, it's kind of grown with our users, and we've seen a lot of excitement around it.
Okay, so 2.0 implies that there was something fundamentally different from the thing we'd been working on, and what was that?
Yeah, so I think we actually had an emulator from the beginning of Android, actually. It was quite fast when Android was, you know, 2 megabytes and 512 SD card size. But since that time, we've had more and more requirements to use the Android emulator. And so we had to actually rethink of how do we actually do it? How do we actually make it more performant with the new requirements of Android? So we decided to rewrite it basically from scratch using a new virtual machine underlying system called Humio 2. And then from there, we added a new UI to have new features for developers. And with those two things together, we decided to call that 2.0 since it's a brand new emulator for developers.
Well, and it was basically so performant, we thought, you know, if you thought in the past, oh, I can't use an emulator. And I think we even said publicly that most people working on Android didn't use the old emulator, right? Because once we got to tablet size, the way that the graphics worked in the old emulator, it got dog slow, right? Everyone on the Android team were using real devices to do their testing, and we said so in public. So why would anyone out there use the emulator unless they didn't actually have hardware, right? Whereas for 2.0, you wanted people to try it again.
Absolutely. I think that's a good thing about the hardware aspect. I think one key thing, I think we in Android, we actually made more of the graphics GPU dependent. And so we were actually having most computations on the CPU. And so that was actually quite slow for a lot of solutions. And so we made a lot of investment actually into making a lot of the graphics pipeline use hardware acceleration, just like we're doing on Android. So we actually get the same performance, actually even better on the new emulator, because unlike a phone, which is using your phone OpenGLS small graphics card, we're actually using your desktop development machine's graphics card. And so that boost of performance is one of the things we added on for the new Android emulator.
But this stuff, correct me if I'm wrong, this stuff was coming along incrementally in the old emulator, in the old 1.x version, right? So we had x86 instruction speed up at some point like 2 or 3 years ago. Similarly, we had GPU instruction speed up on desktop GPUs, again, 2 or 3 years ago, right? So this is not part of the rewrite, or was it not a rewrite? I still am not clear on that. Like, was that just like, well, enough stuff had been added like CPU and GPU acceleration that we just declared mission accomplished and moved on? And that was V2.
I mean, I think that we did a bunch of incremental things, right? So for example, the switch from ARM to x86 was huge because you were no longer simulating ARM. Right,
yeah,
and then Haxim. I mean, you came from Intel.
Yeah. So you know, we've had ARM simulation from the beginning. I think, because a lot of phones were running ARM processors, so we said, hey, let's have an ARM emulation. But the reality is, most applications are written in Java, so it's actually kind of irrelevant to what the architecture is. And so you're correct. To where I used to work at Intel, and what Intel was providing was, how do we have an emulator solution that runs on x86? Since most dev machines are running x86, why don't we have a solution that's running on the same hardware as the developer's machine? And that switch a couple years ago was actually a big boost to the CPU solution, such that now essentially you're sending your x86 instructions from the emulator directly to your desktop machine and getting that fast performance instead of having to do some translation between them. The GPU part, as you've mentioned, Chet, yes, this was incremental. But I think one thing we actually realized is that we had to kind of rewrite a lot of the graphics pipeline calls to make sure they were compliant with the way Android was doing it. And then secondly, there's a lot of edge conditions we have to look at. So actually this past year, we're looking a lot on quality for the Android emulator. And so actually, I think it was yesterday or early this week, we actually launched the Play Store on the emulator. What actually was behind that was that we were actually looking at how do we actually have the same quality and performance as a physical device. And so we looked at the same tests and compatibility tests that were running on physical devices and applied that to the emulator. And by going through those tests, we've actually increased the quality of how we do CPU instructions and GPU instructions for us a better, more performant experience in the emulator.
So does the emulator pass CTS test now like a device?
Yes, that was a goal. You know, if you go to the Android open source website, you can run the CTS test on your physical device and see what happens. And now we did that same test on the emulator. So now you run it on our emulator and you can pass the CTS test just like a physical device.
So you mentioned earlier that like people would tend to use real devices instead of emulators, you know, maybe because the emulator was so slow over time, or, you know, they're Android developers, they have an Android device around and that's certainly easy enough. And it gives you, you know, the exact fidelity your users are going to experience. But it seems like they're still going to need emulators because one of the things about being an Android developer is the vast array of possibilities you have out there, the form factors in different devices. And an emulator gives you easier access to that than you're going to have as certainly an individual developer, right? You're not going to go out and buy an array of 16 or 30 devices or whatever just to, you know, cover the form factors that you think are important for your particular use case. So the emulator allows you to run those. So then even though that may not be your most important debugging and development experience, it's still going to be kind of critical to shipping your app, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way I think about it, the emulator is your go-to development device. Of course, you know, you always want to try it on your device and on your final shipment. But as you're iterating and testing your development device, who wants to have 16 devices hooked up? Who can buy 16, 20 devices? So to be able to spin up 2-3 emulators, try out a tablet phone, all on your monitors on your dev machine and try it out, I think it's a good advantage.
It's also faster, right? I mean, I think pushing an APK to the emulator is faster than for a device, I think, because, you know, it's a local connection. It's not going through USB, potentially flaky USB connection. And I think the emulator did a lot of work to actually make the push speed really fast. We shipped new system images, as I recall,
purpose. Yeah, we looked at the I/O speed, GPU speed, and CPU speed. And so for the I/O speed, yes, it's, I think, upwards of 10x faster than a physical device. And that's basically because we're not going across a USB wire, right? And, you know, again, if you're pushing your APK lots of times, you know, with Android Studio or assets, those little increment time savings is going to be a big benefit in your dev cycle.
So when I am running the emulator on my system, I happen to do development on a Mac. If I'm, you know, looking at the process they're running, what I see is QEMU. How does that relate to emulator? What is that thing?
Yeah. So QEMU is...
I like your little laugh and smile. You're sort of tolerating my question. That's very kind of you.
No, that's a good question.
Sometimes the guests say, that's a good question, Chet. This was like, that's a dumb question, Chet.
But he's going to try to answer it anyway in the kindest way possible. Yeah.
You know, we call the Android emulator as a broader product, but it's actually a couple of different things going on. At the core of it is we have this virtual machine that's running. It's QEMU. It's an open source project that... we've sort of added additional Android goodness to it to make sure it runs our Android use cases. And so actually, if you look at your SDK folder, hey, like what's the emulator actually running? You'll actually see a number of different executables. We actually have a specific instance of QEMU for each solution. If you want to run a 64-bit version or a 32-bit version, we have a specific virtual machine for each of those emulators. And so when you actually run your the emulator, it's actually running that first step, is that QEMU process. And then I think as Tor mentioned, we actually have something else called Haxim. So Intel Haxim stands for Intel Accelerated Execution Manager, I believe.
Where'd the H come from?
You know, I don't know. We added it.
Okay.
And what that does, it basically allows you to send your CPU instructions directly to Intel processors. So since, I guess, for the last 10, 12 years, Intel has had Intel VT instructions, which is what a lot of hypervisors use. And so with this special kernel driver you can install, we can now send those instructions directly to your CPU. So as QEMU says, hey, I have a CPU instruction, how do I process it? It can send it directly to the CPU using this kernel driver called Haxim. And then additionally, we have the GPU stack. And I don't know, Juan, which one stack are we using for a GPU now?
We mostly using the OpenGL driver on the desktop host. But if on Windows, sometimes we are also using DirectX based on technology on Angle. And also sometimes we have to go for a software stack, which is a Swift Shader.
I love the idea that Android is running through DirectX and Swift. wait. That doesn't sound right. Okay, so why?
How do you make the decision?
Okay. This can go back to the original question, like what's the difference of the rewrite? Mm-hmm. It's mostly actually quality. If you look at the first version, the hypervisor hexam and also the OpenGL acceleration is all there. Back then, I'm still working outside Google. I tried to make an emulator work. I can never make it work for a hardware acceleration mode because so many configurations you need to figure out and so many different bugs you will run into. But with the V2 rewrite, like all the quality be improved. So like today you install an Android emulator, it just run out of a box. So I think that's a major difference between V1 and V2. Now back to this GPU stack, because the host driver may have different qualities. Some have a good OpenGL driver. Some doesn't have a good OpenGL driver, but have a decent DirectX driver. So based on that, if the host driver, for example, like NVIDIA has a good OpenGL driver, we'll use OpenGL directly. For some other drivers, which DirectX is better choice, we use DirectX.
So the emulator has like a naughty and nice list, like, oh, if we find this driver, then we're happy we're going to use it. But that other one is known to be bad.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out that. And also for sometimes, based on our crash reports, we know some driver won't work mostly, so we'll fall back to software rendering. And also happens if you do a remote desktop, we use software rendering by default.
Okay. So on a different platform years and years ago, it was a fact of life that the OpenGL drivers were only good enough to render Quake. And if you wanted to do any kind of other graphics that were not Quake or Doom, then you would use DirectX.
And that's because that was what all the OpenGL developers were just using as their test?
No, it's because there was a very important game engine that used OpenGL, and apart from that, there weren't really any real OpenGL apps out there. Whereas DirectX was like all the games and the hardware makers would focus on DirectX first because that was sort of the baseline of this is what you need to do to operate well with Windows. And then OpenGL was an afterthought purely for the game engine. Or at least that was my perspective, trying to do different kinds of graphics there. I thought the world had moved on and there was more general broad acceptance of OpenGL, but I guess Windows is still kind of special, at least for niche hardware.
Yeah, also it certainly depends on your host configuration.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using a desktop, usually the graphics card and the driver is decent, but laptop, sometimes the OpenGL driver is still not there.
I see. Oh, because the it's not going to be like standard NVIDIA cards. It's right. Going to be more cheaper hardware.
Or maybe integrated.
Integrated,
GPU
yeah. Yep. Okay. Okay. So totally different topic. I was reminded when we were talking about the Hexam and GPU stuff, one of the things that was rather painful about using the pre-V2 emulator was that you would install or you would create one of these emulator devices. It's always this process to like get there and actually run the thing. It's like, you don't have an emulator. And you're like, okay, well, I'm going to tell you how to build one. It's like a little Arduino hacker project to get the emulator.
You mean the AVD?
AVD, right.
Okay,
right,
virtual machine.
Right. And so then you would configure options and then you had to download some stuff. You're like, well, you know, when I install from the platform tools, I don't even, no. It was different checkboxes in the, like, go into the SDK manager and you can choose the stuff you want to download. And some of that stuff was like, oh yeah, I would like to hack some stuff or I would like, you know, to do this. And then in AVD manager, you had to check these things to tell it to use this or that. I think that was one of the things that was kind of killing us for a while because even though we introduced these high performance things along the way incrementally, people were not experiencing them, right? They didn't get them by default.
We had a usability bug. So when you downloaded the Intel Hexam manager,
yeah.
You know, normally you'd install like a system image or whatever, but if you install that one, what you really were installing was a Hexam installer, which we did not run. So you had now installed, you know, the script that if you were to run it, would actually install it. And we fixed that a while ago, right?
No, we did, yeah. So that's the good point. First of all, we made setup easier, right? So by default, yeah. We just create the virtual device in the best configuration possible.
Right.
So
right.
That solves that first problem. And, you know, if you kind of go off the rails and we actually have some checks to say, hey, look, you're emulator's out of date or your Hexam's out of date. And actually, we worked with Intel to solve this executable problem where we actually will run it for you during these wizards so that we can help you upgrade. So this is definitely true. I mean, this is definitely a discoverability problem that we had before. But with the rewrite of the emulator 2.0, we also worked on the AVD manager. So if you haven't tried it out recently, the new AVD manager we launched actually a little over 2 years ago as well with the new emulator. Those two things together actually allow you to get down to the best configuration as possible,
right,
creating AVD.
Plus the, you know, the first run wizard, which most of our users don't see. Well, they see it once, the first time you run Studio. And if you've never used Studio before, then we take you through this. Hey, you need an SDK. Hey, you should have Haxum. And then we actually make an AVD unless you uncheck that box. So we try to onboard you, but you know, you're a longtime Studio user and fan, so you may not have seen this.
Yeah, if you're a longtime Studio user and you're like, hey, I've never used emulator. I mean, I met some folks like, hey, I haven't used that. It's slow. It's like, when was the last time you tried it? Oh, 3 years ago. Well, if it has been 3 years ago for you,
they're still waiting for it to launch. Actually,
right. Yeah. They're still waiting, right?
They did the ARM system image,
right? And it's funny. We actually found a few developers who still run ARM, thinking, well, hey, I'm running an ARM device on my physical device. I should run an ARM emulator,
right,
despite us having warnings saying, hey, run x86, it's faster. I would say actually in most cases you should just use x86. We encourage it, and it's actually much faster in performance. So if you're thinking, hey, I should use ARM because I'm running ARM, that's not really going to help you with the emulator. It's actually better just to use x86 for just that better performance.
All right, so ARM versus x86, that's an easy, you know, answer. But here comes the $64 million question.
64-bit.
Should I use 64-bit system image or 32-bit system image?
No, here's the thing. On a real phone, you might have, you know, your 80 some odd apps, and all these apps are running at the same time. Most times you're running just your one app on your phone on the emulator. It's the only thing running. So there's not a lot of advantage of running 64-bit if your app doesn't specifically need that much memory available. So I think honestly, like if you want to use the least resource intensive AVD, just use 32-bit, because that's really just one app running on your emulator.
But so there's no performance. Like if I'm on a 64-bit OS, 64-bit machine and hardware, there's no benefit.
I think it depends on your purpose. If you are using emulator for your main development, I think 32 bits is a way to go. It's use less memory, less resource, and it's most device using 32 platform as is today. But if you are a developer, you want to verify your app works well on other platforms. Some people may go into 64 bits and also some other APIs. But if you use emulator most of the time as your primary development device, 32 bits is a way to go.
So 64 bit is for if I have native code, or if I just want to see, hey, how does this work on a 64 bit?
Right.
Could we offer a slider and then they could go between 32 and 64 and just pick the optimal?
Yeah,
I was thinking 33,
compromise.
37.
33, yeah.
And I also want to add, there are some other usability issues user may run into that prevent emulator for user to run it. Haxum is a big thing. The other one is if you configure AVD, you need to enable host GPU, which hardware accelerated GPU mode. But if you happen to have old AVD configuration file around, now you heard this new emulator is fast, you download it, but your old configuration is still being kept and you still run with GPU off, you will still see it's not as fast as it should be.
Okay, so if they've been using Studio for a while, they may inherit their old properties,
yes,
right?
Yes, even the image, system image itself need to be updated to take advantage of the host GPU acceleration. But if it's a long-time Studio user, or you use Studio like 1 year ago, now you try again, your configuration file and the system image is not updated.
Well, I think system images, we warn you that they're out of date. So you get a little bubble. We have a lot of bubbles warning you about updates, right? Maybe too many. But I don't think we warn you about not using GPU because we assume you didn't want it.
Right. But even the warning itself is part of the usability improvement we made.
Okay.
But I'm saying like 1 year ago, like your user probably didn't realize to take advantage of the emulator improvement, we need a new image.
Okay, so if someone doesn't know if they're stuck in this horrible, horrible situation, how do they then find out? Do they go into AVD
manager?
Just
create a fresh AVD and start fresh. I think that'll do the best spot there.
Okay. So uninstall Android Studio.
No. It's a light. The AVD is actually pretty light. The system images are the bigger aspect. But
if I don't care, like if I'm not trying to do some specific configuration, I'm just working on the functionality of my app, what would you recommend as sort of the best performing device I should use? Like, should I pick the smallest screen I can? Should I pick like KitKat or should I pick Nougat? I'm just wondering, like, what would be your recommended amount of RAM and hardware configuration to pick?
So by default, you know, we create that first one for you, which is right now, I think it's a Nexus 5X running the latest Android version. And I think what we found, a lot of developers will use the target SDK as their sort of max testing area. And then as you're validating, maybe use your min SDK. So I think as you're targeting Android, look at the latest version of Android, and then also just use the defaults. We basically set the RAM at the best state, and we set a reasonable size SD card by default. If you decide to create a large Android screen size for a tablet, you know that will take up more performance for you because we actually have to draw all those things. So if you don't need that, just use the standard screen size, and you'll be just fine.
Actually, how much impact is there if we're using a desktop GPU acceleration, unless we fall into one of these backup situations like SwiftShader? Does it matter? Like, is desktop GPU really bothered by covering more pixels or doing more stuff for a larger screen? Like, those are pretty powerful monsters, right, on a typical desktop machine.
Yeah, I think Juan, you could probably jump in. I personally run, you know, tablet emulators myself on my desktop. I think this usually comes up more. People like, hey, I want to run 4 or 5 emulators at the same time. Then they're have Android Wear device, an Android T device, and the Nexus 10, Nexus 9 screen size, and then it's like, oh, it's too slow. Like, oh.
Wait, does that work well now? Because I think a while ago, at least, when I tried to run that second emulator, it's like, hey, I'm already being used for Haxim by this other process, so you're going to run super slow now.
Yeah, that's a good detail. So actually for Haxim, when you first start up, you actually make a reasonable default, assuming you're actually running 1 or 2 emulators. So I think by default, we basically say, look at your entire system at RAM and set it to around 20% allocation, which means Haxim, when it runs, will take, let's say if you have 4 gigabytes and you say, I want to use, you know, half the RAM available, it'll allocate two gigabytes of RAM by default. But let's say you have a big develop machine, let's say 16 gigabytes on, let's say, a Mac laptop. If you want to run more than 2 emulators, you can actually adjust that up higher. So you say, I want to actually allocate 6 gigabytes of RAM to my emulators. So each emulator can actually now run in this new emulator space and have more performance. If you don't do that, it actually will have to swap out memory between all processes with the allocation that you set up.
So why would I not just get, like, if I have a 16 gig, you know, machine, why would I not give it 15.8? Like, does it actually try to get all of it and hold on to it?
Today it holds on to it. So that's not the best thing to do that, because you have Studio running.
Yeah,
you've
got
Chrome
two
running.
Going to Studio. You've got, yeah, all these other things in the background, right?
Yeah.
All right. But so you're saying there's no issue with having multiple emulators. You just need to make sure that it has enough RAM to do that. So if I've given each AVD about 2 gigs of RAM, I better have, you know, two times.
It is also like a platform dependent. On Linux, the hypervisor is KVM. So when you allocate, you see I need 2 gig for guest image, guest OS. The KVM won't allocate 2 gig upfront. But on other platform, Windows and Mac, we're using Haxim. It need allocate that much memory upfront. So it's first, it's platform dependent. And also another one is, if there's another virtual machine running, for example, like VirtualBox, some others are running, or Hyper-V on Windows, sometimes the two virtual machines may not get along each other. There's several bugs being fixed recently. For example, on Mac, now we can run Android emulator alongside with Docker or VirtualBox.
I see.
That's a good point. So developers, I was going to tack on to that. You know, a lot of developers might want to run Docker to run their cloud infrastructure for the app, and then run an emulator for the host app. So you can kind of do both in one machine. So that now is now solved, because now I can run my Docker cloud backend and my emulator frontend for my app, and have the whole system work on one computer.
Now being whenever, like, master is released, or is this actually already in whatever preview bits we've shipped?
It's released. So actually, Intel actually released it in November, and we actually just did another re-release in the SDK manager. So it's actually available today. Just update your Haxim, and then you can run both together.
To stable users.
Okay.
Wait, so I missed that. What was the fix? What was the problem?
Well, the problem was there was some...
Was this Haxim, like, was you can there can be only one?
Yeah, there's a competing condition between. So Docker had its own hypervisor solution, and then Haxim is another hypervisor solution.
Yeah.
And so they're competing with resources. And so the fix was basically some sort of allocation balancing between the two. And that was a kernel driver fix that was done by Intel. So as I said, they released that in November, and we released the Task Manager a week ago.
So pretend for a moment that I'm not actually a real kind of virtual machine expert.
Sure,
you
absolutely.
Know, just I know it's a well, stretch, crazy, but right? Just pretend that hypervisor means what?
So your machine running directly on hardware is the host operating system. Mm-hmm. The operating system can say, hey, I want to set aside a set of system resources to run another operating system.
Okay.
Right? The software that manages that is a hypervisor. So that the hypervisor is knows about the hardware configuration that you're running on specifically, and it knows how to manage resources with the host operating system.
Okay. So it's infrastructure that virtual machines use.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, let me ask a stupid question. So it sounds like
no stupid questions.
He doesn't let
well,
me
no,
ask.
Well, no, I
all
wanted
to
even the score
questions.
Because Chad already got one.
Sure,
I'm going to see if I can get one. You said earlier that KVM didn't have this limitation of having to allocate it all up front. How feasible would it be to get KVM running on other operating systems, or is it really tied to Linux?
Okay, there's several efforts of like open source efforts trying to port KVM to other operating system like a Windows or Mac. So far, there's no successful project out there. I think there's a couple of reasons for this. KVM is only a part of the hypervisor solution on Linux. There's lots of support from Linux kernel as well. So when you port KVM, you need to see whether those kernel support from Linux can be available on other platform. Another possible reason is there exists solution out there, like for example, VirtualBox works on Windows and the Mac. So there is no immediate need for porting KVM. So I guess for both reasons, we haven't seen a real successful porting KVM of other platform yet.
Okay, I'm gonna follow up with another stupid question. Now we mentioned like several different things, and I don't quite understand what works with what and what are just competing solutions. So there's hypervisor,
the
infrastructure for the virtual machine. There's KVM,
right.
Only on Linux. There's VirtualBox.
Right.
Then there's the actual emulator itself. Like, how do these things plug together? What?
Okay.
Okay.
So like
now Huang's giving me the same polite look. Like, oh no, stupid question. All right.
On the higher level, you have a virtual machine engine which is running on host. You have a guest OS image, which is Android for different API levels. So that's like two biggest pieces of Android emulator. So virtual machine engine as well as the guest image. Now on the virtual machine engine side, there's also two sub pieces. One is QEMU, which is the user mode virtual machine engine. And that's and then we have Hypervisor, which is a kind of like a kernel driver in host OS, and the solution for Hypervisor is platform dependent. And on Linux, that's KVM. On Windows and Mac, we're using Intel Hexam. But for all platforms, we're using QEMU.
Okay. All right. I think I could draw the layer cake diagram on a slide now. Okay.
Yeah.
Moving on.
I'm afraid of a follow-up question, so I'm just going to totally change the subject. So we just shipped the Play Store, right? I know a complaint we used to get is that the Google version of the system images would include Play Services. And every now and then, the Play Services will have an incompatible change. And now all of your old system images are obsolete. Like, they have an obsolete version of Play Services. So it's kind of hard to test, you know, like a Jelly Bean version of your app with Play Services with a new version. Will the Play Store now, because I assume Play Store is how usually Play Services gets distributed to devices. Does this mean that we can now have a system image that supports up-to-date Play Services?
Yeah, that's one of the main drivers. It's the reality is, if you haven't noticed, we actually update the system images for the Google images every 6 weeks. Actually, let me back up. We actually have two versions of the images, if you haven't noticed. One is called the AOSP version, which is this plain Android version, which is you can download from the open source project. The other one we have is the Google APIs version. And what that includes, as you're right, Tor, includes the Google Play Services APK, Google Sign-In, and Google Maps. And those three apps are sort of the basic fundamentals you need to test out your application. So historically, what happens is that every 6 weeks, we actually put out a new version of Google Play Services to all users' devices. And then we subsequently will update the system images at the same time. And that delta sometimes can be a week or a couple of days, and that's kind of frustrating to know what's going on. So what happens normally on a real device is that the Google Play Store in the background is always updating Google Play services automatically, so you don't ever have to think about this. So one of the motivations to have the Play Store on the emulator is now the emulator can use the same mechanism as a physical device.
So this wasn't actually just so that people can sit and watch Netflix on their desktops.
Right, right. It's the update Google Play service is the big one. Okay. And the second one is a lot of developers want to try end-to-end development. So let's say I have in-app purchasing, or I depend on a secondary or third-party app that might be on the Play Store. Previously, I wasn't able to test that flow out. So now you can actually do end-to-end testing of exactly how your users would use your app all within the emulator. And then I'm back to that first point about the Play Store being updated. So we're still going to continue to update the system images on a regular cadence. But now with...
And that's just so that if I install it, I don't have to then wait for it to discover update. That it's obsolete.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And then at least from API 24 and beyond, we are sort of committing to do the Play Store. So that's the plan so far.
We're committing to 24 and beyond. So we're not necessarily going to go back and put it into Jelly Bean and Ice Cream Sandwich.
Yeah, that's ambitious. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as you may imagine to...
Oh, I don't imagine that it's easy. I figured building those system images at this point has got to be kind of tricky.
Yeah, what actually happens with Android is that every version, we actually put out new testing requirements. And so after a certain while, those actually become end of life. So it's hard for you to actually ship old versions of Android with those apps on there.
I think it's probably even hard to check out the source code and build it. I figure it's probably using old compilers and old operating systems.
That's absolutely true.
I mean, I know we have an issue with this in Android Studio. You know, we have to build the launchers, the native code that goes into the launchers, and those require old versions of Xcode on Mac and Visual Studio and so forth. And it's kind of tricky to keep this build environments pristine, right? Because you want to upgrade for the newest, but then when you need to build something older, you have to have the older version.
Exactly. Yeah.
And also based on the initial feedback from community, so right now we have a Play Store on API 24, and most people are asking, are you going to have a Play Store for API 25 and 26 going forward? And then there are some people asking for old images, but certainly much less.
Okay, that's good. Are there any other use cases for having the Play Store? Do people like need to install companion apps, or is there anything like that?
Yeah, as I mentioned, companion apps. So let's say you might have, I don't know, dependency on Google Play Games, for instance, as for your leaderboards or something of that nature, that might be only on the Play Store. So there's sometimes these dependencies that you will be kind of stuck testing if you don't have a Play Store there to help you.
Speaking of companion apps, I remember Zav did a demo many, many years ago where we had a new feature on the emulator where, let's say you have an app that wants to talk to sensors, right? So you want to, for example, recognize that, you know, the phone is being tilted or something. And this is very difficult to do with emulator because you want to feed it fake data. And how do you do that? So, you know, we had this companion app that was basically an app running on your real device. And you would hook it up to your emulator through some sort of port. And then you could stand there and move your phone around in your hand. And, you know, what I'm doing in front of the microphone, I was moving my hand. And then the emulator would sort of respond because it was being fed those sensors. So you had some sort of way of...
I remember that, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
and we actually shipped that app, I think, with our tools. I don't know if we still do. We probably... Because no one's noticed that it's still there.
I think the source code's still floating around there. Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't have a great job of maintaining that for a little while. So to help for that first gap, we actually launched a set of virtual sensors. I think also last year as well.
That's probably the 2.0, I think.
The 2.0, right. And there you can say, hey, I want to try out gyroscope, accelerometer, light sensor, the movement vectors. All those are now built inside the emulator. So there's this nice little 3D, three-dimensional device you can kind of move around virtually to simulate these movements. And also you can toggle the different sensors that are available. We are thinking about the sensor app again. It's something, maybe my pet idea I want to work on at some point. But we certainly need to revamp that to make it work with the new versions of Android. But in the meantime, we do have these virtual sensors that are there that you can at least use the entire range of sensors that Android provides and try it out in a virtual environment.
And you can use that with, like, I can send fake GPS. I can basically decide where the GPS results.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are
so
as well.
So in addition to virtual sensors, hopefully you guys have, there's an extended controls panel on the emulator. So of course, when you load the emulator, you see the nice Android launcher screen, and you see a little toolbar on the side that has, you know, the play buttons and screen capture of that nature. But at the very bottom, there's a extended controls. And there, if you haven't opened it up, hopefully you have, we have things like GPS, like how do I change my location? You can do that as well. You can do things like make a phone call or send a text message. So if you have an app that uses those APIs, you can now validate those things. And other things include things around the virtual sensors. And we have a few more things up and coming we're really excited about, but as we add more features, we'll actually add them there to allow you to control those different APIs.
I'm just thinking that if we now have that and we have the Play Store on the emulator, people could now download like the Pokemon app, right? And they could really become power users, right? By just feeding whatever locations they want.
Well, you know, the thing is, the emulator is one part of the story, right? So on the Play console, you have controls about what devices you might want to include or not include when you're shipping. So potentially you could do that.
You're saying app developers can decide whether or not they're going to allow their apps to go to the emulator.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Hopefully no one from Pokemon.
And the focus is obviously for your own app, right? So if you play other people's apps, you know, that's technically possible, but it's really focused on how do you test your own app, right? And see how it works.
I didn't realize that this podcast was actually about supplying gamer cheats.
I didn't know that. That's just one more service we provide.
Are you a Pokemon Go player? Or?
I'm not, but my kids were.
I see.
So, you know, this could be a way for me to, you know, become relevant again.
Hey, you know, we could put some like clickbait ads on the podcast now about, you know, gamer cheats and stuff.
Let's, yeah.
We need to work on a mission statement. I think this is clarifying what I want to do here.
You know, we can hack the emulator to give you gold in Clash of Clans or whatever.
I actually want to note something that's actually kind of different though. So historically, if you use the emulator, we've shipped something called user debug mode of emulator. So what this means is that you would be able to, on the command line, type in root, and you have root access to see the entire file system of your emulator.
And that's super useful.
Super useful for developing your application. However, with the Play Store, we've upped the ante a little bit and say, hey, we need to be compliant with how real devices actually work. So if you use a Play Store version of the emulator, it's user builds. And user builds are the same sort of lockdown as you see a physical device.
So, that makes sense. So people can't just go and grab APKs and so forth.
And start hacking on them. But we have both the AOSP and the Google APIs version. So if you require digging into the hierarchy of the system, you can do that with the AOSP version, but there won't be a Play Store on that version. But the Play Store will be only the user builds.
Right. I mean, one thing I've noticed that when I try to debug or develop on a real device, you know, and the device monitor comes up, it only lists my process because everything else isn't debuggable. But on the emulator, of course, there's a lot of other things that are debuggable. So, you know, it's less realistic in that way. And so I guess if you're developing with the Play Store image, it's more like developing on a real device.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right. What else are we missing?
I think boot time is certainly something that I wonder, is there anything we can do or have we thought about that? Like when people talk about the slowness of the emulator, one of the things that hits me occasionally, like unless you're sitting there using it, you know, all the time on your desktop, you're probably not running it all the time because it is taking up resources and processing time, right? So I'll quit this thing and then I'll go back and I'll use the emulator later and then I'll wait for a while for it to boot. Now, it did get way better once we started using the Haxum thing because we're actually running, you know, machine desktop instructions to execute this thing. But you're still looking at a regular Android boot time, right?
Well, it's actually a little bit faster. I mean, it's something we're looking at, like how do we make it faster? That's something we care about and how do we solve that? But for sure, in comparison to at least 1.0 version to 2.0, it is faster because if you look at what's happening is when the phone's booting, it's actually using a lot of I/O time to like load stuff from the virtual disk into the memory. So by increasing the I/O speed, we've actually made the boot time faster than a physical device. So you're not waiting that same amount of time.
Yeah.
But we're not done there. We're thinking about how do we make that better, and that's something we're thinking about how do we do that more efficiently.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I think I've stopped waiting for the emulator. It's you know, it's a little bit annoying, but it's not the oh no, I have to do it again. You remember the old one with you had that little Android logo in the center and sometimes it would never even come up. So you're like, I don't know if it's crashed or if it's still working. That just hasn't happened. How much of a resource hog is it if I'm just leaving it in the background all the time? Like is the Android OS at that point getting woken up all the time, deciding to keep the clock pixels up to date in the status bar? Or is it really kind of, if it's not in the foreground, is it basically free?
Well, you know, unlike a simulator, this is an actual Android device. So it thinks it's alive, right? Yeah. So it's
I know it thinks it's alive, but, you know, we could just sort of not update it.
Yeah. So if there's no bug you encountered, Usually when you boot, it'll take maybe 40-50% of single CPU.
Yep.
If lead in the background, it should be less than 5%. So if you're seeing it's higher usage, CPU usage than that,
what was the percentage you said?
5%.
Okay.
I thought I was seeing something more than that. There is a QEMU bug, though, that I have filed and would love to see fixed, where after bringing the computer back awake from sleep mode, it'll peg it at 100. Right. I don't know if that's our thing, if it's coming from, you know, the open source projects.
If it's 100, it's definitely a bug.
Yeah, and, it's definitely a bug.
Let us know. File bugs, please. We need that.
It's filed. It's filed. I check on it occasionally. I pet it.
Speaking of the 40-50% during startup, I have noticed that when I start, there's about, you know, a 1 second point when it decides to completely do, I don't know what it's doing with the OS, but my music will skip, right? So if I have music on, suddenly the music stops playing for about a second, then it just starts again. And I'm thinking that's got to be like the kernel module that's kicking in and sort of just like getting no one a chance. I don't know if there's anything you can do about that. It's not a big deal, but yeah.
Yeah, so the bug actually, when you mentioned it before to me in the office the other week, I did file it for you. It's on our to-do list.
All right.
But if that's an issue for you, please start on our bug tracker, if that's something, and tell us the scenarios. Speaking of bug tracker, we actually, you know, we may not have been as responsive in the past, but, you know, with our new relaunch of the emulator, we're actually pretty responsive to the bug tracker. So if you have issues, please let us know and have good repro steps so that we can address it. And we look for you have that crashes. So if you see a little dial-up box that comes up, say, hey, I have a crash, send to Google, we actually address it. So if you don't send us to Google, we don't know if you have an issue. So we appreciate both bugs and those crash reports to see how we can make your situation better.
The other strategy that I have for getting issues known is to invite you onto the podcast and then bring up those bugs.
That's a strategy. That's awesome.
Public shaming. Well, that sounded like a call to action to me, so... Yep. Doesn't get better as an ending.
Yeah, I think that's especially important where, like you mentioned this, I've seen this dynamic out in the real world where the emulator was so, you know, unusable for people's core use cases before that they gave up, they found other solutions, including just, you know, they depend on the real devices or whatever, and they may not have come back. We think it's now in a way better place where people should be able to use it. If it is not, it'd be nice to know why.
And, you know, we've had developers who say, I've relied on some other solution before in the past. It was faster, but now I've tried the emulator. Now it's better and it meets all of my needs, right? So that if you haven't tried it in a little while, give it a try. And I think you might be surprised on how fast it is and futuristic it is. And, you know, it's offered free, of course.
And now how compliant it is.
Compliant it is, that's great as well.
And like Wang was mentioning before, if you are one of those users like, okay, I don't believe you, but I'll try it again, make sure that you actually create a new AVD to make sure that you're getting all the nice default settings instead of just inheriting the old slowness that we used to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us.